Welcome, everybody. Can you hear me? Great. I think this is our biggest audience so far for a desert island retreat. Up a bit, he says at the back. Up a bit. Up a bit more.
Okay. Up a bit more.
Up a bit more. Is that okay? Yeah? Great. Okay, good. So, how fantastic. What a great audience for Padmavajra, for his desert island retreat. So, I'm at this point of the evening, I'm always a little bit nervous. So I just collect myself and overcome my nerves. Thank you, Anna. Padmavajra needs very little introduction in Sheffield. He's our much beloved president and has been our president for 14 years, and we've greatly benefited from your friendship during that time. So heartfelt thanks from all of us. For those, I'll just introduce him a little bit for those of you that don't know. Padmavajra is one of our senior order members. He lives at Padmaloka, and he works on the ordination team and has done for 35 years?
Since 1990. Whatever that is in
35 years.
Maths.
Yeah. He's been a private preceptor, and he is a public preceptor, and he serves on the Public Preceptors College, which you've just returned from, I believe.
Yeah.
And you've also been the Men's Mitra Convener for Europe.
Still am.
Still is the Men's Mitra Convener for Europe.
The whole of Europe.
The whole of Europe. And since you've been our president, you have visited us faithfully every 6 months and spent a week with us and has just worked incredibly hard during that time that you've been here. We just had a little conversation earlier about you've got to make work play, so maybe you would say you've played hard.
Yes, definitely.
But you've seen a lot of people. You've given a lot to us. You've taken the order members for study. You've taken the women mitras, the men mitras. You've given talks at Sangha Night. You've led pujas. You've led celebrations. Wow. We're all very grateful. And we will miss you a great deal when you step down. Somebody said earlier, you don't know what you've got until it's going. But I think we did know what we had, actually. I think we did know. But yeah, just brings it into focus a little bit more. But the focus of tonight is your life and the tracks that you have collected together to tell a little story of your life. So we're going to enjoy listening to the tracks and hear a bit from you as well. So let's start. Yeah. So you were born in November 1956 in the London borough of Hornsey.
Correct.
Do you want to tell us a bit about your early life?
I don't remember much about growing up in... Well, the first 2 years of my life were in a ground floor. Well, Mum and Dad were renting a ground floor in a terraced house in Hornsey from Mr. and Mrs. Whitehead. I don't know how they got that. And it was very much, you know, Mum and Dad, working class, big North London families, had two older sisters. I was had 8 years after the youngest. I was a mistake. That's what my sisters told me. That was a kind of family joke. You were a mistake. And I did ask my mother years later, what was that all that about? And she said, well, I was told not to have another child after Judy, the youngest of the two daughters. But apparently I came out very easily. She was enjoying her lunch, her salad lunch in the maternity hospital, and I was coming, and off she went to have me. She was disappointed that the lunch had been taken away afterwards. Dad was a plumber. Mum kept the home, but she also worked because they were poor. So it was a tin bath in the kitchen, outside toilet, as it was for many people in those days. But when I was two, we moved to Sussex.
Yeah.
In a place called Hassocks, just north of Brighton, beneath the South Downs. And so that's where most of my, well, probably all of my early memories are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where you spent your childhood and your teenage years.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
And your first track reminds you of that time with your mum?
It does. Well, shall I say what it is? Okay, so I immediately thought of this when we were going to do this. And it's actually one of my oldest memories, if not my oldest memory. So we're in the front room or the lounge, whatever we called it, in the semi-detached we lived in Sussex, and I've got a wonderful feeling of warmth and maybe the smell of drying linen and baked bread, and the radio's on and I'm snuggling up to mum, and I can remember how it came on, and now Daphne Oxenford with Listen With Mother. And do you remember? I could remember. I never forgot that name. And for some reason, that stuck in my mind. And I think Daphne Oxenford, who had that, one of those wonderful voices, those, you know, sort of proper old-fashioned BBC voices, which are vanishing now. It was something like, "Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin." And the music for that... I love the music for that. And it wasn't until many years later that I found out what the piece of music was. It was the first movement of Gabriel Fauré's Dolly Suite, which I think, I'm not very good at French, Berceuse, which means lullaby. I think he wrote it for his daughter, and it's for four hands. So that's the first piece, and it just brings back just a wonderful feeling of warmth, safety, comfort with mum.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Let's hear the track. Beautiful. So it sounds like a very stable, happy, secure childhood. Happy times.
Yes, well, Mum and Dad were very, I mean, you know, they were very hardworking. And family was everything, really.
Yeah.
I think I was very fortunate to have such very good parents. I mean, they weren't perfect. You know, who is? But I feel very, very grateful to my parents and my mother. I mean, they weren't educated because they came from a class and a time when people didn't have that benefit. But they were intelligent people, upright people, with quite strong social commitments and in some ways religious commitments as well. And you know, they gave everything to us. They really did. You know, and you know, I'm so grateful. Mum was an amazing homemaker. I mean, she really was an amazing homemaker. You know, I can't really eat marmalade these days because Mum made the best marmalade ever. And
nothing,
jams and things like that.
Nothing, you know, matches it.
Nothing. How could it? You know, it's from your mother.
Your mum's marmalade.
Yeah.
But you described, when we spoke before, around 7 or 8, your dad had an accident.
I think it was a bit earlier than that. It's all a bit hazy, but Dad's accident was a thing. And that happened when I was a very, very small child.
Okay.
I must have been about, I think, maybe 4 or 5 when that happened. I'm not quite clear. It's hazy. And Dad went through the windscreen of his car on a foggy night on a country road coming back from work. So he used to drive for miles for work. He'd leave very, very early in the morning, come back late at night, and, you know, eventually he started his own little central heating company, but he was a hands-on plumber, you know, and he almost died, and so there was Dad's accident, and I don't really remember very much about that, but apparently after that accident, I got very frightened of the dark, and bedwetting started and all that sort of thing. So I got really, really scared of the dark, and going to bed was so hard. I used to resist and resist and resist and, you know, sometimes run away and things like that, you know. But I hated the dark.
Yeah.
You know, I'd have to sleep with my door open and the landing light on, and and I'd stay awake until everybody had come up to bed and things like that.
But this leads us to your second track, doesn't
it? Yeah.
Okay,
so I had two older sisters. Suzanne was the oldest. She's still alive. And Judy, who died, what was that, a couple of years ago now. They were very different from one another. Sue was thin and dark. Judy was sort of slightly tubby and blonde and blue-eyed. And they were really, you know, they had an intense, you know, relationship. I think my father, even he couldn't bring peace at times when they started up. And I was sort of in a different sort of sphere in the family, my own little sphere in some ways. Anyway, Suzanne, I don't quite know, Judy must have been away or something, I can't quite remember, but I'm not quite sure what age it was, but it was definitely around 7 or something like that. When Suzanne went to bed, I'd go and sleep in her bed with her because I was so frightened of the dark and lie there in the dark. And then after I dozed off and when Mum and Dad came to bed, Dad would come in and I've got vivid memories of him picking me up and putting me back in my own bed. But I mean, then I could sleep. But so the memory there is lying there in the dark. And Suzanne used to listen to Radio Luxembourg, you know, pirate radio all the way from Luxembourg on a very poor transistor radio. Anyway, we were lying there one night. I think Suzanne was probably asleep and I was sort of lying there. And on came this incredible track, these incredible chords.
Yeah.
And it was I Can See for Miles by The Who.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely thrilled. I knew this was like real music, you know. this had a kind of weirdness to it, and a great sound.
Yeah.
I can even remember, I think, what the DJ said, that it was something like, even the name The Who sends tingles down your spine. Something like that. Anyway, so this is the next track.
Yeah.
You're a pussy cat, you're where it's at, the one that's in on every play.
The Ian's out.
Big girl.
Speak easy, drink easy, pull easy. Hold your groove together with Road to South Sea.
I know you deceive me, now here's a surprise. That you have, cause there's magic in my eyes. I can see for miles and miles and miles and miles and miles.
Oh yeah.
If you think that I don't know about the little tricks you play, never see you when deliberately you put things in my way. Well, here's a poke at you. You're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile, because all the while I could see for miles and miles. I could see for miles and miles. I could see for miles. Of my trust in you when I was so far away. I saw you holding lots of other guys, and now you've got the nerve to say that you still want me. Well, that says maybe, but you gotta stand trial, because all the while I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles.
That the opening bit, I wanted this track specifically, not the single version, but from an album by The Who called The Who Sell Out, which my sister Suzanne's husband gave me. This is the famous Who album with Roger Daltrey in a bath of baked beans, and it's full of advertising jingles. And I thought, throughout the whole album, it's a fantastic album. And I thought that would, remind me of listening to Radio Luxembourg and things like that. And, and I just love that echoey sound and the rhythm and, that sort of, it was like coming from another place, 7 years old in the dark.
Yeah.
But I felt really, I didn't feel frightened of the dark, partly because I was with Sue, but also because, I don't know, it made the dark acceptable, that music some ways.
Yeah, and we were reflecting maybe the I Can See for Miles was a kind of a bit of an antidote to the dark,
I didn't think of that. That's a very good insight of yours, I think.
I can imagine you maybe doing your Pete Townsend impressions,
of course, with a tennis racket eventually. That was in front of a mirror.
But maybe on the beach on the desert island as well.
Oh, I could do that. Yeah, I could make my own guitar, couldn't I? Not very good at making things, but anyway. So
I think we're getting an image of the time and that you were growing up in, and the excitement of this new music that was coming through.
I don't know if I was precocious or not. I've got nothing to compare it with, but I mean, I was interested. I mean, music was top of the pops.
Mm.
All those things were happening. I mean, my sisters would listen to Motown and things like that. That was around. But I was quite, and of course there's the Beatles and all that, but I was always curious about odd sounds, I think. My other brother-in-law left Sergeant Pepper's with us, and we had one of those mono record players, and there was a period where every morning before I went to school, I'd play as much of Sergeant Pepper's as I could, so I could sing the songs at school.
Yeah.
You know, but that was primary school.
Yeah, you know.
But I remember looking back, it was the weirder songs that I liked best, like Day in the Life and Lucy in the Sky and all that. Yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah.
So we're going to come to your unusual music taste in your teens in a bit.
Yeah.
Well, okay. I think they were quite unusual, actually, for a teenage boy.
Yeah.
Anyway, but we're coming to that. But before that, you spent quite a lot of time at church.
I did, yeah. We were a church-going family.
Mm.
Where we went to church was in the next village, a village called Ditchling, just along the road from Hassock, where there was a number of churches we went to. Ditchling was the main one, sometimes Clayton Church, which was nearer to us, but there weren't so many services there, which has incredible old frescoes in it. Anyway, don't get distracted. But we went to Ditchling, and I was in the church choir.
Mm-hmm.
So I wore a blue cassock and a white ruff, and, you know, so I'd sing, you know, sometimes. And it was, there was a lot of people who go to that church. It was, when's this? I don't know, late 60s, early 70s, something like that. But church going was a thing, you know, and, you know, so I'd sing in the choir. I'd sing the psalms and, you know, Nunc Dimittis and Te Deum and all that, Magnificat. And even it was a real music church. Mm. So we'd even do passions at Easter time and of course, the Christmas service and all that. Sometimes I'd go to church three times a day, you know. And also eventually, I think when my voice broke, I didn't sort of graduate to another voice, but I did do, I was, we called them servers, an altar boy, so red cassocks, white surplices, you know, helping the vicar, the priest, to serve the communion. The first time I did that was, I mean, they didn't give you any instructions, and I can remember the old vicar, Canon Singh, who was a very devout man, so he held out, you know, the goblet, the chalice, and I'm pouring the wine in, and I didn't stop. And the thing was, after the priest gives the bread and the wine, he's got to drink all of it. And when we got back to the vestry after that, he looked at me with a very benign face and said, next time I'll signal to you when to stop. You know? Yes. And my next choice is to do with that, really.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is a memory of your father.
Well, my father loved music. He loved classical music. Mm. I mean, I can remember seeing him. We didn't have many records. Well, he didn't get many records, but I can remember seeing him getting very passionate listening to a Max Bruch violin concerto and things like that. And he sang at times, you know, in choirs. He had quite a good voice. Mm. But the memory I have is that in our church, and of course this is an old, you know, Norman church, you know, it's a beautiful old church. Mm. So sad seeing these churches now. Mm. So run down, but one of my memories of him is we always had a very good organist in this church. And at the end of the matin service, so that's the mid-morning service on a Sunday, there was always I think they call it an organ voluntary.
Mm.
So Mr. Lovegrove, he was the organist and choir master. They always have names like that. Mr. Lovegrove. Bald-headed man, very passionate. he'd play a voluntary, and my father would, everybody would be leaving, saying goodbye, chatting. Yeah. My father would always stay and listen right to the end. Mm. And I really had the feeling of a man who is kind of old-fashioned, really, you know, a working man, and this was a special moment. Mm. So my next, and, you know, there was a whole, like, so many, he just didn't have the opportunities, like my mother as well. But I think he did have a sensibility, and, you know, I think I saw it at times like that. So, shall I say what the next piece is? Well, the next piece is not a piece of music Mr. Lovegrove would have played. It's the last movement of Olivier Messiaen's, the great French composer's, I can't do the French, The Nativity of Our Saviour, God Amongst Us. And I've chosen it because it's quite, it's very joyous, it's very alive, it's very celebratory. Mm. And this links in with my love of Messiaen's music, which I discovered in the 90s. So I don't think Dad would have, he might have, he was full of surprises. I mean, it's a shame I never had the chance of playing him something like this, because he might have really got off on it, you know, because he was quite a passionate man, my father. Mm. So there we are. Two things coming together, my love of Messiaen
and your dad.
And a lovely memory of my father.
Yeah. And it's quite a passionate track.
It is. Be ready.
We're going to start in the middle, and we'll see how loud we go. It's quite a blast, isn't
it? An unusual choice for a desert island, but anyway.
Quite the track. I should say that recording was played on the organ at the Notre Dame Cathedral. So I think you can hear it, can't you? You can hear the echo. Yeah. So you went to church a lot. You were an altar boy in the choir. How did you feel about going to church?
Well, I wasn't. I sort of went, but I wasn't really into it, I suppose. You know, I wasn't devout or anything like that. You know, I was just a very ordinary kid, really. I mean, I just liked playing football and mucking about and, well, any kind of sport, really, and really not very good at school at all. Hopeless. Always getting into trouble. It's got a lot worse at secondary school, but I was bored, terribly bored by school, and in some ways bored by church, although I think I did feel there was something going on in some ways. I mean, a terrible confession as an altar boy. I mean, I'm not sure I should say this, but anyway, it's coming out, it's all coming out. It's got to be confessional, isn't it? I mean, I can remember, I mean, when people used to come and take their communion, I mean, me and my other altar boy, we'd just be looking at the really pretty girls. I mean, that was, you know, while everybody's taking the body and blood of Christ, we have quite different, I mean, not in a lustful way or anything like that, but we have quite different things in our minds and things like that. And I can't say that I really believed in God. And Christ was never a real figure for me or anything like that. But I do remember, culturally, it was very important. I can still remember, you know, things from the Book of Common Prayer and the Psalms and things like that. So in some ways, there was a kind of forming of the mind. And I did have a feeling for something higher. I think I subsequently discovered that. So it was a real mix as a child, I think, and as a teenager, I think I was just incredibly confused, really. I mean, on the one hand, I think there were some unusual aspirations. But on the other hand, I was just an ordinary kid. I mean, really dead ordinary from a very ordinary family. You know, and sometimes people say, oh, what would you have done if you hadn't been a Buddhist? And they think, I'm going to say something amazing. I said, well, I'll tell you what I would have done. I would have probably ended up working for Dad eventually, give in to that. Married a local girl, local woman, had loads of kids and, you know, played football every week and things like that. And sort of looked back later on in my life wondering, well, what was that aspiration I had when I was a younger lad? You know, maybe that would have been a good life. I don't know. But, you know, I don't think it would have been anything particularly sensational. I guess I would have done what my parents and my sisters and my brothers-in-law had done. You know, it would have been a bit like that. But it wasn't to be.
It wasn't to be. Which kind of brings us to a bit of a turning point in your teenage years and your exploration of music. Do you want to say a bit about
I'll talk a bit about music. Was such an adventure, and I don't quite know. I mean, I used to get the Melody Maker and the New Musical Express. There's obviously no internet in those days. And, you know, I'm going to secondary school, so I'm meeting, you know, other people. I can't remember what the genesis is, but, you know, there's a kind of graduation from the music, you know, you're getting through the radio and television. And there's a graduation to, you know, prog rock, King Crimson. They were really important for me. Early King Crimson, saw them a couple of times. Early Pink Floyd, not later Pink Floyd, when they're much more spacey and interesting, more psychedelic, and of course there's that interest as well that starts to happen. And, you know, going on, there's an interest in jazz that really starts to open up. I like the saxophone and some of the prog rock people I was listening to had saxophones. That led me particularly to American jazz of the 1960s. And, you know, the more out there jazz, if you like, I can't remember how I got there. But I became more and more adventurous, even took up the clarinet and wanted, as with everything I've done in my life, wanted to run before I could walk. So in the end, I just made a lot of noise. But yeah, it's particularly the catharsis, I suppose, if that's the right word, is listening to John Coltrane at 20 Friars Oak Road, Hassocks, Sussex. Mum and Dad might be watching the telly. In the other room with the gramophone going, and this music is coming out of
it. It's amazing music. So the track you've chosen is called A Love Supreme by John Coltrane. Shall we just talk about that particular track and the title as well? Because that's quite important, isn't it?
It's very important. And in fact, I think the importance of that kind of emerged quite recently, quite powerfully, actually. But that this track, but also other tracks by John Coltrane, I can't even quite remember which track really did it. I mean, he had this incredible tenor sound, like nobody, and soprano saxophone as well, but he had this sound which, I don't know how you do it. I mean, he was technically brilliant, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about this quality that just goes straight there. I mean, it's I won't even just say to the heart. I'm talking about the sort of central nervous system. And when I first started to listen to this music, I just went into ecstasy. It was, I mean, now I could probably say it was some sort of dhyana. There was a higher state of consciousness just opened up. It was like I leapt over or I leapt out of wherever I was. And, you know, I discovered that Coltrane was into Eastern mysticism as time went on. But I actually kind of turned listening to his music into a meditation. Where I'd switch the lights off, I'd put this music on, I'd sit cross-legged, and I'd try to replicate the experience I had. And I was probably 14, 15 when this was going on, and discovering not just a world of incredible music, you know, and you can feel the suffering in Coltrane's music, you can feel the blues, you can feel that journey. You know, that whole background, you know, it really is great black music in that way. It's just great music, but you can also feel that sorrow being transformed into something of an utterly extraordinary nature that sort of transcends its background, if you like. And incredible. Yeah, incredible. And then I'll just say a bit later. After George Floyd's murder and all the stuff erupting about that, I did a lot of reflecting on how important black culture, black American culture had been to me. I still want to write something about that. Weirdly, for a kid in a semi-detached housing estate in Sussex, and how I'd benefited hugely from you know, black music, not just John Coltrane, but others as well. And so I still want to write about that. And when all the sort of, you know, polarization was sort of going on in the world, I just found myself chanting A Love Supreme, which John Coltrane does like a mantra over and over again. I mean, it just seemed that and I still believe that that's what's needed, you know, a love supreme, not just any love, but something supreme that kind of breaks through everything.
Fantastic.
¶¶
So this is you as a teenager, living just outside Brighton, going to Brighton a lot, picking up music in the second-hand record stores.
And the Virgin, when they started, I mean, they were a mail-order company, but then they started a few shops, and there was a really big one by the Clock Tower in Brighton. It's obviously not there anymore. And you could go in there, and they had an amazing import section, and you could get that. They were kind of hippies, I think, running it. It was a decent business in those days, I think. And they would stick on records, and you could go and sit on these bean bags and put headphones on. So, I mean, I'd bunk off school in the afternoons, nip down there and, you know, and just spend my time listening to fantastic far-out music.
Yeah. Great. And you left school at 16.
Yeah, I left school at 16, or rather I was told I wasn't welcome to return. I'd done my O-levels, and let's not even go there in terms of how much I failed. And I was walking along the corridor one day, and Mr. Feely, the head of the upper school, who was very blunt speaking, I think Liverpudlian, he just said, "Hutton," that was, you know, the family name, "Hutton, what do you think you're going to do next year?" I can't do the accent, apologies. "What do you think you're going to do next year?" I said, "Well, I thought I'd come back." "I don't think so. You wouldn't be welcome." And I was such an arrogant little twerp. I said, "Well, I won't come then," you know, and stormed off, you know. I mean, but I was unteachable. I really was. I was always getting into trouble, you know, and I really was getting into trouble. I mean, one thing I will say, John Coltrane actually became a sort of spirit guide. Mm. I didn't tell you this when we were preparing this. So the first acid trip I did, I did at school. I was so excited when my friend who scored the acid, that's the way we talk those days, brought the acid to school. I couldn't wait to take it, you know, because that's what you had to do. You had to have a trip and you had to have a good one.
At school.
At school. Talk about daft. I was so excited, so quickly into the toilets, into the box, you know, I'll just take half. But of course, let's have the whole lot. And then, I mean, it was just insane after that. And I have very little memory of what went on, but apparently I started to behave rather strangely. But the reason why I thought I could take it was because I usually didn't go to games, the two-hour game session, PE. And then I got this incredible paranoia that I... After the initial rush had kind of gone away, I thought, I'll be found out. You know, what will mum and dad say? So I went to PE, and it was a road run. And, so, you know, running around the streets of Brighton. And I was just running as hard and as fast as I could. And as I was running along the road, I looked across the road, and John Coltrane appeared on the other side of the road and said, "Just keep the thing happening. Just keep the thing happening all through." I think it was something I heard on one of his recordings. So I'm very grateful to John Coltrane on my projection onto him.
So I didn't know that was coming out. Great. Desert Island Disc Gold. Fantastic. So, So about this time, you came across the FWBO.
Yeah, so that was after I left school at 16, and I was working a weekend on a market garden growing tomatoes. And they offered me a full-time job and... day release, as it was called then, to go and study horticulture at a local agricultural college. And I got myself a moped and a provisional license so I could go, you know, on the little roads all the way to Plumpton Agricultural College. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really into it, I'm sorry to say, but I think actually the work was good. Mm. Good physical work, you know, just getting my hands dirty and things like that, hard work. And I was continuing to intensify my interest in music, reading. And one day I realized I needed to find out something about Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism. Mm. And I went to, I was also playing music. Me and my friends, we play a lot of free improv.
Mm.
You know, in other words, make a lot of noise. That was quite important because I realised, well, there's no way you're going to be able to play like John Coltrane. I mean, because that you don't have that experience.
Mm. Mm.
So the discovery of European free improv was really important.
Mm.
So I used to send away for some pretty far out pieces of music. Anyway, that's a detail. So anyway, I went to this local bookshop called Symposium, and I asked for, have you got any books on Tibetan Buddhism? And Chris, who subsequently became a mitra, but then left the movement, he recommended Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism.
Mm.
So I devoured that.
Mm.
I mean, I can't say I understood it, but I thought, yeah, this is it.
Mm.
I mean, I like reading things I don't understand.
Mm.
But I thought, this is it, really. Mm. And then The Way of the White Clouds, you know, his account of meeting his teachers.
Mm.
And what was really clear was that Buddhism was offering a higher life, an incredibly detailed description of higher states of consciousness with no limit, no creator God, no end to that.
Mm.
And that was a possibility for human beings.
Mm. Mm.
And if you meditated and you found a teacher, this was achievable. That was really clear to me. And I you know, and various other experiences happened, opened up in different places, even before I left school, actually, not to do with drugs or anything like that. So things were kind of opening up. So I was searching, and in the local hippie shop where I used to get incense and posters of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, actually. Do you remember Tantra Designs? Used to get that stuff. There was a little note saying that the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order are thinking of starting a centre in Brighton. Contact this address. And I immediately went along there. I mean, I thought, Friends of the Western Buddhist Order? So they're not really Buddhists. They're friends of Western Buddhists. But, you know, I thought, well, it's not exactly the ancient order of the old Padmasambhava followers. But anyway, it's the only gig in town. So I went along, and very friendly people there. And I went along. I went back when there was an order member there, an order member named Buddhadasa. And I found what I was looking for on the first night, which was a full-length metta-bhavana, a sevenfold puja. When I was chanting the mantras at the end of the puja, I knew what my life was. I can't tell you how I knew, but I just felt a complete joy that this is it now. I'm actually going to be an order member. I only just met one. I kind of knew. It's weird.
Oh, wow.
It was very weird. But, well, it wasn't. It was very natural, really. And not long after that, I got sacked from my job and left home.
So the natural response was to move in with the Buddhists in
Britain. That's right. I started to go down there as much as I could. And Buddhadasa got hold of a couple of terrace properties in Brighton and turned them into a little community in a centre. And you know, when I got this, I mean, there was a lot of, it was a bad time for the economy and a lot of businesses were going under. And I think they could see that I wasn't really committed in this job. So they gave me 2 weeks' notice. And for some reason, I just thought, I can leave home now.
Right. So this was 74?
74. 74.
So early 70s.
Yeah.
And your mum and dad, what did they say?
Well, I mean, they knew I was getting into Buddhism because basically my shrine room was a bedroom. My bedroom was a shrine room, and they used to show it to visitors. I had all these posters of deities all over the walls, you know, I was really, really into it. I mean, and they must have thought, well, you know, it's an adolescent thing, which it was in some ways. Anyway, I went down to Brighton for the Friday night study group and I said to Buddhadasa, I said, look, I've got the sack. I want to leave home. Can I move in here? He said, yeah, sure, come.
And you were how old?
17.
17.
Yeah. And I went back home that night, got into the, I thought, how am I going to tell them? Because they're very close to mum and dad. And you know, mum was really good at making me feel guilty. You know, it was very difficult to stand up to them. I didn't want to displease them. Anyway, they were watching telly. Dad was probably smoking his pipe. Mum was probably knitting. And I went in, and mum was concerned about me getting another job. And she mentioned that. And I said, actually, no, I'm not going to do that. In fact, I'm going to leave home. I'm going to move in to the Buddhist community. And mum said, no, you're not. No, you're not. And when mum talked like that, I'd always cave in, you know. And for some reason, I just didn't. I said, no, mum, I'm actually going. And I think she could tell from my voice that I wasn't going to alter, because I didn't get angry. I just said, no, mum, I'm going. And then she started crying and started to push it a bit more. And Dad, I think quite wisely, just said, let the boy do what he wants. He called me boy when I was in my 50s. you know, let the boy do what he wants. His view being was, let him go. In a couple of years, he'll be back, you know, with his tail between his legs. Don't worry, Joan, you know, he'll be all right.
It'll work out.
It'll work out. And, you know, years later, not long before he died, he said, I told your mother, well, we'll give him 2 years. And you have proved me wrong.
Right.
Yeah. But I didn't never cut off from my parents.
Yeah.
I love my parents very, very much, and love going to see them.
So you moved in to the Brighton Buddhist Centre, to the community there. You weren't there very long, were you?
No, after a couple of years, I moved to London to the old centre, or the only London centre in Archway.
Yeah.
That became Punderica, and I lived in, that was squats.
Yeah.
That was pretty squalid. So this was, all these communities around the centre.
Yeah.
So I moved in there, and it was from there that I got ordained.
Yeah.
You know, at 19.
Yeah. So that was 1976.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about your ordination.
I'd met Bhante, of course, you know, not long after I moved into the Brighton Centre. Bhante turned up. He'd just got back from New Zealand, his first tour of New Zealand. And Brighton was an old stomping ground of Bhante. And he was really pleased that Buddhadasa had started a centre. And he came down to see us. And, of course, I decided that Bhante was my guru, you know, listening to all those lectures, the Tantric Path series.
So you were listening to tapes of him?
Yeah, cassette tapes, reel-to-reel tapes.
Yeah.
There weren't many books. I devoured the Survey of Buddhism.
Wow.
I mean, apparently I was a bit of a pain, because I'd carry the survey around with kind of bookmarks in it, and I could quote it to order members, you know, and I think they thought, who's this whippersnapper, you know, knows more the Dharma than we do. And there weren't many books. There was the Three Jewels, there was the Survey, Mind Reactive and Creative, The Essence of Zen, and there were the tape lectures. And there were translations, Bodhicharya Avatara. You know, I just devoured everything and anything. Yeah. And I made a connection with Bhante almost immediately.
Yeah.
And we corresponded a bit. It was very encouraging. And very playful with me. He could see my... I went to see him at his little place he was staying in Castleacre in those days in North Norfolk, and going into his room, it was full of... There were tankers and rupas and this beautiful Amitayus tanker. And I said, oh, who gave you that? And he said... He said, oh, I think that came from the Panchen Lama or something like that. And asking about his teachers. And And he was very, very encouraging. Very encouraging. Yeah. And yeah, he let me take up, very importantly for me, he let me take up the Going for Refuge and Prostration practice before I was ordained, which was unusual in those days. And it was the Padmasambhava refuge tree. And that was a hugely important practice for me. I mean, I wasn't really that good at meditation. I was too restless. So very, very strong devotional practice, puja, prostrations. I mean, I was trying to do 100,000. So eventually I was getting to the point of doing, you know, at least 100 a day, sometimes 200, sometimes 300, you know, really going for it. And I mean, I was really young, had a lot of energy. And it was only really after practicing like that that I could really meditate. You know, then I could really concentrate. And I wrote a lot to Bhante. One day, well, I must have told you the story. Well, I'll tell you, have I got time to tell you the story? Or do you want
I don't know. What's the story?
I'm longing to be ordained.
Okay.
As is my friend Ratnakuna, who wasn't Ratnakuna then. And one day, and we didn't have a telephone at number five, and one day Dharmadina, who was the secretary of the centre, came round and said, Bhante's on the phone for you in the centre.
Okay.
So I legged round. No, and Bhante didn't have a telephone, so he would have been calling from a call box, red call box in a village in Norfolk. So Bhante came on the line, said, hello. I've got a message for you. In fact, Padmaraja is with me, and he's got a message for you. Here he is. So Padmaraja came on the line. He's very, very intense. You need to be at number five. You and Gary Hennessy need to be at number five, Balmore Street, next Friday at 12 o'clock. Cancel everything else. Just be there.
Wow.
Okay. And then Bhante came back on and said, have you got that then? And I said, yeah, I've got it, Bhante. I've got it, Bhante. And he put the phone down. So there's this bizarre image of Padmaraja and Bhante hobbled into a red call box. And Padmaraja appeared with two blue Basildon Bond envelopes, handed them to me and Gary, and we opened them. And it Bhante saying, after consulting with the order members that have ordained you, I've decided that know you. I've decided to ordain you. You can either be ordained later on in the summer at our new retreat centre, Papaloka, as it subsequently became, or next weekend. And Ratnakuna and I spontaneously both said next weekend. So we were ordained in a farmhouse in Thetford Forest on a weekend retreat.
Yeah, that's a great story. No, you hadn't told me that one. I love that image of them squeezed into the telephone box.
Very playful. Very brilliant. Lovely.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're in Archway.
I need to go to the loo.
Okay.
Is that all right?
I think it has to be, doesn't it?
Has this ever happened before?
No.
Oh, God.
But we have just had a great meal and, you know.
It was all that chai.
So that chai, all that delicious chai.
It's all right, I nip off.
Yeah. Intermission, yeah.
Thank you.
So intermission is over. Back to the exciting times of 1976.
Yep.
So just ordained.
Yeah.
And I think you went to Bethnal Green to help out with the LBC.
That's right. So yeah. Lokamitra, who I'd become very close to in Archway, he left. He went off to India.
Okay.
To do a pilgrimage and yoga. In Pune, and there's a big story that develops out of that. And I was a bit sort of rudderless, and so I asked to move to Sakavati, as we called it then.
Yeah.
We didn't call it the London Buddhist Center then, and I just joined that community and just became a laborer.
Yeah.
Working there. Not a very good worker, I don't think. But Attila did eventually teach me a bit of bricklaying and a bit of plastering.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was like meditation, prostrations, you know, visualization practice and labor.
And knocking down walls.
Knocking down walls, yeah.
Yeah. And the soundtrack, which we're not going to play, but.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It wasn't mantras. It was the Sex Pistols had just come on the scene. Punk had just started.
Yeah.
And I think under other circumstances, I could quite imagine it becoming a punk, actually. Mm. I mean, it was very exciting, you know, and there were all the sort of news headlines about how terrible they were and all the rest of it. But never mind the bollocks. Never mind. Here come the Sex Pistols. That is the title of an album. And I did a lot of banging down walls listening to that, not to mantras. It was good, rough music for that, actually. I mean, I did get into a bit of trouble with sort of minor trouble. Anarchy in the UK got banned in the UK. I went down to an order weekend in Purley from Sakavati, and in Purley there was a really good record shop, and I went in and I said, have you got a copy of Anarchy in the UK? And they did. They got some from France or somewhere. So I took it back up to Ariatara. They were all in a puja the order weekend, and in the lounge there was a record player, and I stuck it on. I was excited, and I can remember Naga Bodhi, a former president of the Sheffield Buddhist Centre, bursting into the lounge saying, "You wretch! What are you, ruining our lovely atmosphere?" Arloka, who was there, had a rather different response. Sounds like the Stooges to me. Anyway. A little flirtation with punk from a distance.
Great, yeah. Great story. We're not playing Sex Pistols tonight, though. Sadly. So You had a spell in India shortly after this, didn't
That's
you?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, crazily, I got interested in going to India.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if I'm honest, I didn't want to work, and the prospect of going to India, Loka Mitra was looking for people to go out to India, and I rather madly volunteered to do that, and I sort of thought I might even meet some of Bhante's teachers, actually, which I did. But and also Bhante had talked about, well, he used to use the language of ex-untouchable Buddhists, and you know, I'd seen photographs of him giving talks to them, and I was in a lot of contact with Loka Mitra, so I asked to go. I subsequently learned Bhante wasn't very keen on me going. Quite rightly, I was much too immature to go, and I had a very hard time when I was in India at first, a very, very difficult time. Became extraordinarily homesick, not for Buddhists, but for mum and dad and the football results on Saturday afternoons and toast and comfort, really. But I did eventually connect, particularly when Bhante came out for his first visit, and I was about to leave, actually, and we got news he was going to come in a couple of weeks. So I said to Loka Mitra, look, I'll stay and help to get everything ready for his visit. And that actually enabled me to stay for a lot longer. I did getting on for 2 years that time.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most important periods of my life. It was very existentially challenging in all sorts of ways, so many, you know, but so many things I learned in that situation from Indian Buddhists, and I formed a connection with India and subsequently that is so strong. I mean, on our recent preceptors college meeting, we had Indian public preceptors, both men and women, and the India Day, as we call it, was such a highlight. I mean, so moving, and so I mean, this very particular feeling, and some of the Indian order members telling their life stories, and when I'm with those order members, something comes out in me that comes out nowhere else. I can't really describe it, you know, you know, where they've come from, and that whole vision of the Dharma as a radical social transformation. And seeing the way Bhante taught, that was a huge initiation, I would say. The way he taught the Dharma in India. I mean, it was just extraordinary. And his compassion, that's the only word I've got for the way he was with that community. And I had a very good connection with him during that time. Some of the best, because I decided I'd just serve. So I was a sort of attendant, and that was my level, and in some ways that is kind of how I'd prefer to live. I think in a future life I just want to be reborn as a really good attendant of a great being, you know, and have that responsibility. In some ways, all the things that responsibilities I have now, I'm not really suited to them, I don't think. You know, I think I'm much better at serving.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were just 22 when you, at this time, I think you had.
I had my 22nd birthday in India.
But you came back after a couple of years and you moved into Arihatara?
Arihatara Croydon, because the word was, this was a really happening centre with a lot of younger people. I mean, like real young people in those days, you know.
Not people in their 40s.
No, exactly. And, you know, I knew Padmaraja, you know, from the old days. You know, it was the one time the Mitra convener. I moved there, and that was a very, very intense 6 years. And, you know, probably people have heard about the difficulties in that centre. And there were a lot of difficulties, and I became part of the difficult set of difficulties until Bhante told me to leave. That's a whole other story. But there were really good things there too, not least culture. you know, of all kinds. Mm. I mean, we ran a very successful art centre with some really interesting things going on. And Bab Maharaja, one of the things he did, he was really into art. Mm. You know, he introduced me to, I mean, very memorable for me was going to a big Cubist exhibition at Tate Britain, I think, and really opening my eyes to Picasso and Braque and Gris and that whole movement and, you know, all the stuff about perception. But he was also into things like Renaissance paintings and things like that. So there was a whole cultural development. I read a lot of poetry, you know, there and music.
Mm.
Yeah.
And this next piece is from that time.
That's right. So in the movement, generally in those days, there was a great passion for Baroque music. Mm. I mean, Banti was very keen. I think he references in one of his lectures Monteverdi's Vespers, because that got performed, I think, in London around that time.
Mm.
But there was a big passion for Baroque music and, you know, that whole movement of so-called authentic performance. So bands like the English Concert, the Academy of Ancient Music, and so on, as well as, you know, German, Dutch, there's so many French performances. And I got really into that music. Mm. But the abiding discovery during that period was Purcell.
Yeah.
You know, some say is England's greatest composer, who died very young. And I used to listen to a lot of Purcell, not extensively. There were things I just listened to over and over. And this, there was an LP we had. I don't know if I bought it, but it was in our collection in the community. And it was Music for a While.
Yeah.
And the singer was Alfred Deller, with a bass viol, viola da gamba, and harpsichord accompaniment. And it was Purcell's songs, some of his songs. Deller was a really interesting man, a real pioneer. He developed this notion of the countertenor.
Okay.
Because in Baroque music, of course, the castrato was, you know, there was a lot of work for that male high-pitched voice. Yeah. And he developed a way of singing. And this particular song is Music for a While, which is from his opera Oedipus, which John Dryden wrote the words for. And it's all about beguiling Alecto, who's a very ferocious snake-headed goddess.
Okay.
And I like the cover of this album because it had a picture of Alfred Deller in a kind of leafy summer garden. And I associate it with English summer gardens. And on my desert island, I'd like to have memories of leafy summer English garden. So, you know, I am English, British, I don't know what you call it these days, and I'm not a nationalist or perhaps even a patriot, but I do feel that my roots are here.
Yeah.
I noticed that very strongly during lockdown, you know, that.
But
I don't believe that cuts me off from any other influence worldwide. And, you know, my taste in music is pretty Catholic and open. But I do have that feeling for, in this case, an English country garden.
English summer gardens.
Yeah. So,
well, let's hear Music for a While by Henry Purcell.
Oh,
Beautiful. Beautiful. So, from Croydon, you went back to India. And this time Bansi was really keen for you to go, I think.
He asked me to go.
He asked you to go. Yeah.
Or strongly suggested I went.
Partly because of what was going on in Croydon.
Partly to get me out of the way, I think. Okay. And I think for two reasons. Partly to, because I was in the way of things changing. And I think partly because he cared about me, actually.
Mm.
And I think he could see that, and also I could make a real contribution in India.
Okay.
Yeah. So I went in 86 to India, and I was mostly in India between 86 and 1991.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you spent another period of time there working really hard for the Dharma.
Really, really, we really went. First of all, I was in Bombay. I told Lokamitra I was coming, and Lokamitra wrote back and said, "You're in Bombay."
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, in those days, you didn't discuss much. Nobody asked you. You just told.
Told where you were going.
Which, in a way, was a much easier kind of way of operating. And so I was in Bombay initially, and I sort of branched out into other places. But that was a really important time, working very closely with Indian order members. And we did an incredible amount of Dharma work.
Yeah. Full on.
Full on, yeah.
So this next track kind of loops back to your teenage years.
It does.
But also encompasses this time.
That's right. So let's do it from India, and even the earlier period in India I would have heard this sound. Yeah. So early in the morning I might be in my flat in Bombay, or I might be in a retreat center in a village or somewhere like that, and there would be this particular sound that would come on. It was I'm still not quite sure what instrument it is, whether it's a violin or a sarangi, the Indian string instrument. And it was the, I suppose you'd call it, the theme tune of all India radio. And it was amazing. And I'd wake up, and sometimes if it was in a city, you'd hear this sound, this very haunting melody, coming up with the call to prayer from the mosques, Hindu mantra chanting, you know, horns in the railway goods yards, mills, you know, sirens going off, and you'd be coming into a waking state. And then I realized, hang on, I know this sound.
Okay.
And I'd first heard it in Hassocks.
Yeah.
Listening to an album called Escalator Over the Hill,
yeah,
by Carla Bley and the Jazz Composers Orchestra. Mm. And they sample, it's an early example of sampling, the All India Radio sound.
Okay.
And then Don Cherry, a great jazz pocket trumpet player who played with Ornette Coleman, another great hero of mine, he does an improv over this sound. So I'm waking up with this sound and then being thrown back to Sussex, but I'm also thinking of an imagined New York and Don Cherry and all that. So it's a lot of things coming together in this.
So it's, let's hear it. All India Radio.
Thank you.
banker in the back row, really enjoying that track. Fantastic.
The thing was as well, imagining this happening all over India.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, from the Himalayas to the south, yeah. Everybody waking up to that.
To that sound, yeah. So you were in India for the second time for about 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think Subhuti invited you back to England.
To Papaloka, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I joined the ordination team and
yeah.
haven't left.
Yes. So tell us a bit about that move from India back to Papaloka.
Well, what can I say about that? I mean, I was doing very good work in India.
Yeah.
But I think there was a lot of lack of confidence, I think. Mm-hmm. I've always had a lack of confidence, and the kind of the events in Croydon, I think, and Aryatara kind of added to that. So there was always a huge doubt in whether I was doing any good. Mm-hmm. Looking back, I mean, we were doing amazing things. Mm-hmm. I think what was really lacking in my life was really, really good peer friendship, I would say. Okay. Mm-hmm. And arriving at Papaloka in 1990, there were people who... Well, I was with Subhuti and Sona, who were, you know, people I really looked up to. Mm. But there was also Aloka and Surita, who, though they're older than me in ordinary years, that we were ordained in the same year. We're kind of a generation that came in after the kind of big guys like Subhuti and Lokamitra, but only a few years later. And I discovered with them this kind of, you could almost call it a sort of parity. Mm. Though I have enormous respect for both of them and learn a lot from both of them. But we just gravitated together a lot. Mm. And there was this sense at that time we were really helping Bhante.
Yeah.
Because Bhante had handed over, you know, ordinations to a team and preceptors. And, you know, we were just completely devoted to our teacher and to the work of the order, the best of the work of the order. And I think the ordination team at that time and the retreats at Papaloka did bring about a sort of renaissance in the movement generally. And and of course there was a parallel thing going on in the women's wing as well. And it was just, I think I really kind of began to grow up properly at Papaloka, and you know, to my great surprise, eventually became the chairman there, the last thing I'd expect to be. But I just realized I loved it. Yeah. I was sort of prepared to do anything. I think that's what responsibility really is when you love something so much, you do not mind. I mean, parents know this, but you know, and you have, if you're not a parent, you have to discover it, I think, in other ways. And I realized I love this. I just love this, what we're doing, all aspects. So I don't mind doing something that I'm not comfortable doing. And, you know, hugely important time for me. Yeah.
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 Well, and, well, we can move on to the next track, which is Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan.
Yeah.
So, and I think Subhuti introduced you to this
he
music.
He did. Yeah. Well, there's a number of introductions to this. Yeah. So this is Allah Muhammad Yachar, I think that's what it's called, isn't it? And it's from that.
Chaya.
Yeah. Okay. It's that real world, one of the real world things he did, Peter Gabriel's label.
Yes.
I was in Guhiloka, I think, on an ordination course, and I went down to see Subhuti, and he played me some things from this album, which completely electrified me. And I'd been getting into Sufism for quite a long time, precipitated by Bhante. You know, it's different seminars, you kind of indicate different things, and I'd been off for years exploring. You know, the great Sufi writers, Ibn Arabi, a little bit Rumi, but others, all sorts. And also discovering tremendous sort of atmospheres at the shrines of Sufi saints in India. And this was the discovery of Qawwali, which is the Indian and Pakistani and Bangladeshi, I would imagine, were the devotional music of South India. And Nusrat was one of the exponents. I subsequently discovered that kind of, you know, not everybody was entirely happy with Nusrat. But anyway, be that as it may, this track I just found incredible, particularly it's a song to Allah, Muhammad, the early caliphs, and then the Chisti saints. The Chistis are the great Sufi order of the Indian subcontinent. And I got very into going to the tombs, the dargahs, the shrines of some of these figures. But this track, what I like about this track is that it's, well, just it gets a bit mantric. And there's this incredible cry that starts to emanate from Nusrat and of longing for, well, what do you call it? I don't know. It's full of ishq, passion, love.
And his amazing voice.
Incredible voice.
Thank you.
Thursdays are the day you go to the Dharga. So I went. I probably used track of time, but maybe I could listen to that on what I think is a Thursday, and that would be my communion with the saint.
I think you said something about it was a vocation. You were using it in your sadhana practice.
Yeah, I mean, people sometimes ask me about the sort of Sufi stuff, but I mean, it's very, very connected with devotion, particularly to the deity I meditate on. I can't really say in what way. I can't tell you. It's just very, very deeply. I won't even say personal. It's just sort of secret in the sense of the heart. But yeah. Might say more about it later.
So 35 years at Padmaloka.
Yeah.
And good times?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's always, I mean, you know, what life is like. There's always ups and downs and, you know, difficulties largely of one's own making. But I live an immensely privileged life. You know, I live in a fabulous community. You know, we have a cook, you know, we have a gardener, we have a chairman, we have managers, we have assistant managers, and, you know, we just have to, the ordination team just has to get on with teaching the Dharma. I'm an immensely privileged life, and not just at Papaloka, but throughout the movement, you know, and that includes visits to Sheffield and Berlin, all sorts of places. I mean, I do complain sometimes, but I mean, it really is absolutely disgraceful to complain, really. I remember Lawrence Durrell saying that when he was being interviewed, the novelist, saying it would be disgraceful to complain. I'm having a hell of a good time at the moment. And, you know, a really privileged life. Yeah.
Well, it's obviously suited you very well. You've stayed a long time. And, and the guys all love going to Padmaloka, so there's obviously something great about it. We're kind of coming to your last track, aren't we?
Yeah.
And this is a Messian track again.
It is, yeah.
Do you want to say this about it?
Well, it's a late Messian piece. Messiaen was a very devout Roman Catholic, and he composed music to illustrate, I don't know, illustrate isn't the right word, but to evoke the myths and even the dogmas of the Catholic Church. But I mean, he's a very unusual Catholic, I think. There's so much to say about him. And one of his late pieces translates from the French as lightning over the beyond. And, you know, it's very much to do with eternity. And this is, it's made up of very short movements. And, you know, I won't even try to do the French. I think the English translates as abiding in love. And when I heard it, I've never heard it performed live. When I heard it on, I was probably listening to Radio 3 and it came on. I just thought this is music that is transcending itself. Yeah.
Thank you. So, coming to the end, it's time to cast you away, I'm afraid, onto your desert island retreat of who knows how long it will last.
Not longer.
Until you get rescued. How will you survive on the desert
Not
island?
Not very well.
No?
I'm a terribly impractical person.
So your dad didn't pass on the
Alas, no, he despaired of me, I think, at times.
Okay. Yeah. And you'll struggle without company.
I will.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
I'm an extrovert. Mm. I think that's what you call it.
Mm.
I just have to, it would be a great challenge for me. Mm. Yeah. But, you know, I've had my Buddhist training, so I should be able to make something of it. Yeah.
And which track are you going to save from the waves?
I think it would be that Messiaen piece.
The last track.
Yeah. I think I'd like to abide in love.
Mm.
I think I'd really like to do that. I think that would be really, really crucial. Just to abide, you know, metta, brahmavihara, metta vihara. Yes, I think that would be really important, and that would be a way of also bringing living beings closer to me. Yeah,
great. So I'm going to give you all of Bansai's memoirs.
Fantastic.
To read.
Yeah,
you can choose between the Bodhicaryavatara or the Dhammapada.
I'll take the Bodhicaryavatara.
I thought you might do.
Thank you very much.
And this is your book of choice. It's not really, actually, but,
<It's okay. laughs>
but tell us what it is.
Well, it's a book called The Sawani, or The Sawani, by Ahmad Ghazali, the famous Sufi brother of the more famous Al-Ghazali, who wrote The Duties of Brotherhood. And The Sawani means something like, very hard to translate, the inspirations from the realm of the pure spirits. And it's all about ishq, which is another one of those words impossible to translate. It's written in Persian, and you can't really call it a treatise, but it's inspirations on the subject of ishq, which means love, passion. But the way Ahmad Ghazali is talking about that is he's saying that, and he doesn't even use the word Allah or God in the text. It's either it or him. And the whole idea is that reality is ishq. Reality is love. And we are created out of that love. And the whole task of what we call the spiritual life is to go on a journey in which ishq takes a hold of us. Ishq as ultimate reality takes us, as it were, back to itself. And Ahmad Ghazali is really interesting, as a number of those Sufis were. He says all love. Love for anybody, for anything, is really love for reality. You might not realize that, but it is. And also, you are not in charge. You think you've started the journey, but you haven't. You're being called back. And I don't know, this language appeals to me very, very much. So it's basically going to be a lot of love on my desert island.
Great. And I'm going to give you a luxury. And what would you like to take as your luxury?
Okay, what survives are rolls and rolls and rolls and rolls of canvas. With prepared canvas and gallons and gallons of different coloured paint.
Okay.
And lots of paint brushes. And what I'm going to do when I'm not meditating, when I'm not being called back to the reality of love, I'm going to listen to my music and I am going to make incredibly colourful paintings.
Great.
That just blow the socks off of everything.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And Aloka will be very pleased with me.
And maybe you can bring them back and put them in the shrine room.
Maybe I'll just throw them into the waves. Maybe there'll be one of those things, you know, that only I know. Yeah.
Okay. I think that's it. Thank you so much, Padmavajra. It's been a great delight.
Thank you, Prajnashree. And thank you very much. You've drawn out so much from me, you know, when we talked on Zoom a bit back and in this interview, you've pulled out all sorts of things. You're a very, very good interviewer. Thank you.
Yeah. Very enjoyable. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And we're going to come back to A Love Supreme to play us out. And I just want to thank Prani Hridaya doing the music and the tech so well. No glitches at all. Fantastic. Thank you.
Love Supreme.